The role that Iowans played in the Underground Railroad and the fight against slavery was nearly lost to history. But a new book tells some remarkable true stories of bravery and commitment. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. The book Necessary Courage, Iowa's Underground Railroad in the Struggle Against Slavery, represents the culmination of the Iowa Freedom Trail Grant Project. For years, historians and archaeologists have been working hard to uncover the fascinating stories of the Iowans who assisted those who sought freedom in the North. Today, I'll talk with Lowell Soike, author of the book, and archaeologist Doug Jones. Join our conversation after the news. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. And this hour, we're going to talk about the Underground Railroad in Iowa. Over the last 11 years, the Iowa Freedom Trail Project has been working to research all kinds of stories about the Underground Railroad in Iowa. And over the last 3 years or so, I've been checking in with archaeologist Doug Jones. He and others have been researching this history. And now a new book, Necessary Courage, Iowa's Underground Railroad and the Struggle Against Slavery, tells the stories that have been uncovered. With me today is the author of the book, Lowell Soike. He's retired from the State Historic Preservation Office of the State Historical Society of Iowa, and he was director of the Iowa Freedom Trail Project. Hello, Lowell.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Yes, thank you. I'm glad to be here.
And also with us is archaeologist Doug Jones. He is the Iowa Freedom Trail Grant Project Manager. He is also based at the State Historic Preservation Office. Hello, Doug.
Hello, Charity. How are you?
Good. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
And we will all be together again this afternoon at the State Historical Museum of Iowa at 4:30. We're going to do an interview there, followed by a book signing this afternoon as well. And that is a program that is open to the public this afternoon. And gentlemen, I want to start not with stories about the Underground Railroad, but let's go back and talk about politics in Iowa, because we know that Iowa was always a free state. But that doesn't mean that everyone in Iowa was opposed to slavery. Let's go back before the Fugitive Slave Act. What were people in Iowa thinking and feeling about slavery?
It was divided opinion in those years. Quite a portion of the population in the 1840s and 50s had, in fact, the first group of settlers that came in were more from upper south folks, just sort of like the folks that settled southern Illinois and Missouri and stuff. These were people from Kentucky, Tennessee, Virginia and stuff. So a fair number of the population in Iowa during the early years was those folks that settled in the southern counties, and then gradually found more starting to arrive from the northern border states, and I think by the 1850s you see a great surge of folks from Ohio and stuff like that. But all this affected the political climate as it as the years went by and as the slavery issue rose.
Well, and you mentioned the influx of people moving into Iowa from the south and settling in the southern part of Iowa, which of course bordered on Missouri. So in that part of the state, were people pretty much pro-slavery?
Well, they were pro-Democrat. In general, they weren't so much wild about slavery or wanting to get slavery to Iowa. But they did carry their southern traditions with them of being anti-black, not wanting blacks to move into the free state of Iowa. But they were also, there was a part of them that was, they were accepting of slavery because that's what they had grown up with over the years. I guess you would have to say that they were more anti-abolitionist than they were pro-slavery.
Okay. But there were people in that part of the state, and as things developed and this issue became more and more divisive, there were certainly people in Iowa in that part of the state who were strong abolitionists. And in your research, you have uncovered the stories of some of those people. Doug, can you tell me a little bit about some of the individuals that we know about that lived in southern Iowa that were involved in the anti-slavery movement?
Sure. You know, there were some noted exceptions in southern Iowa where a lot of abolitionists wound up coming to and settling, and particularly early on in the 1830s and 1840s, you had many friends or Quakers arriving in Henry County, at eventually at Salem, Iowa, and also in Lee County at the New Garden Settlement. You also had Congregationalists coming in very early on, too, and Denmark, Iowa, down in Lee County, was a noted abolitionist hole from the Missourians' perspective. And both Denmark and Salem were on the radar screens of the folks in Missouri as likely suspects when their slaves tended to disappear. Those were some of the places where they first came to look for people, too.
And of course, those would have been some of the first places that people seeking freedom out of Missouri would have reached, because, of course, as I mentioned, Iowa and Missouri share a border. So if they were trying to get out of Missouri, that's a natural place to go.
Absolutely. Yeah.
In the early years, most of the runaways from slavery in Missouri crossed the Mississippi over into Illinois, and that was because Iowa was hardly yet settled, and so there would be no incentive to head north into the uninhabited reaches of Iowa, where you probably wouldn't survive. But then, as the 1840s came on, and greater settlement occurred in the state in southern Iowa and stuff, then it opened up a new door for runaways to go north into Iowa and then cross over into Illinois from there.
And I want to talk about some of these specific stories that you write about in the book, because they are really remarkable histories. But before we get to that, you know, when I was growing up in Iowa and we did our studies on Iowa history, there wasn't a lot known about the Underground Railroad in Iowa. And there were people, and I grew up in northeastern Iowa, there were people who would tell stories about, oh, you know, that old barn was part of the Underground Railroad. You know, there were mm-hmm. always those kinds of stories. And it was just rumor or legend. Mm-hmm. And Doug, I mean, talking to you just a couple of years ago, it really was in many ways just that as far as the historical record goes as well. So let's go back 11 years when you started this Iowa Freedom Trail project. What was actually known about the Underground Railroad in Iowa when you started doing your research, Lowell?
It was a scattering of articles about individual events and stuff, but not much that talked about the reaches of the Underground Railroad as a whole. When the state legislature asked us to do a study, to propose a study bill for what it would take to do a study of the Underground Railroad in places around the state, we started digging through materials, what we could find, and what we found was just those kinds of individual stories that weren't connected.
Well, and it must have been very hard to uncover this history because, of course, and again, you write about this a great deal in the book, the people who were helping people who were seeking freedom, who were conductors on the Underground Railroad, took this on at great personal risk. And, of course, they had to do everything they could to hide their involvement in the Underground Railroad. So was it really difficult to find records of this kind of action, given that people weren't going to write things down and they weren't going to tell all their neighbors, hey, guess what we just did?
Yeah. Yes, it's true that there's not much in the way of individual letters of the time or things like that. What you find is when the Democratic Press, who was pro-slavery in those years, they would be reacting to the event of somebody having been rescued and in a negative way, and that what are these people, you know, betraying the Constitution, it's right of the South to keep their slaves and stuff. And so we learned about those events through those kinds of press reactions, pro and con, a lot. And then you had the second generation of folks that didn't want to see some of these stories forgotten, the children of those that had been involved. And in the 70s and 80s, you found – 1870s and 80s, you found those appearing in articles ending in biographical sketches of people as they died that would reminisce about the times.
Well, and I have to say that as I started reading the book, I was – worried because I thought, you know, it's not going to be the happy endings that made it into the newspapers at the time. And yeah. you were able to tell stories of successful escapes and yes. successful attempts for freedom. But I would love to visit, before we get to our break, let's talk about the story of John Walker and his family. And I'm not sure which one of you would like to start us off by telling this story. But John Walker's a man who was escaping slavery, and he made it to Iowa, but then he returned to Missouri to try to rescue his family. Tell me what happened.
That story is something that surprised me when I got into the project, because we ran into other instances of where people ran away to freedom in Iowa, but then wanted to go back and get their other family members. And they were willing to risk that to make it happen. And John Walker was one of those. He had already come up to Salem in 1848. And then he must have talked to folks around there about, if I can get my family, could you be waiting across the border and help them by picking him up and taking him to Salem? And so he traveled back to the farm. Ruel Daggs was a farmer in near Luray in Clark County who had like 20 slaves. And so John Walker got his family member, his wife and three children, and then also there were four others that joined. Nine altogether, and they escaped one night, and they were able to make it through the rain across the river. And then some boys in their 20s from Salem picked them up in a wagon and headed toward Salem. In the meantime, of course, you had the owner had gotten his son involved in chasing down the folks, and he got a neighbor to go with them, and they headed up for the border following them, and they were right on their tail as they approached Salem. They found the wagon in a bunch of trees, but with just the folks from Salem there, they didn't see anyone else around. That's because they had seeing them on their tail. They had unloaded them there and put them into the brush nearby at a Dr. Siviter's place. And so then the slave chasers ran into Salem and tried to organize some help, and they got a couple fellows to help them, and they went out searching and around town, and didn't have much luck until the next day. And they, when they were able to find them in the brush south of town, and then it all became very turbulent because the townsfolk didn't want them to take the slaves back to Missouri, insisting that that they have to have a judicial hearing in order for that to happen. So they were able to make the slave catchers and all the slaves come into Salem, where they had a hearing, and the hearing pretty much said, well, you have no proof that you have the authority to take these slaves back, and so are these people back, or that they're slaves of yours. So we're going to free them. And so then, with about 2 days later, 3 days later, I guess, a whole mob of folks from Missouri that had been rounded up, and they headed right to Salem, and they sort of closed the town down and searched through all the houses and all that. But by that time, they had moved the runaways to other parts, more east toward Denmark. And
but that is a wonderful illustration of just how incredibly dangerous it was to help freedom seekers, because when the people came up from Missouri, they were bearing pistols and knives and they were angry.
Yeah. One thing to bear in mind is that we call people anti-slavery, but there was all varieties of anti-slavery. There were people that would attend, like so much today, you know, people that attend meetings and sign petitions, but then there are others who go the next step and are willing to actually physically help those in distress.
Right, and put their lives on the line in doing that. We'll continue our conversation in a moment. I'm talking today to Lowell Sohi. He is the author of the new book, Necessary Courage, Iowa's Underground Railroad and the Struggle Against Slavery. With us as well is archaeologist Doug Jones. He is the Iowa Freedom Trail Grant Project Manager based at the State Historic Preservation Office. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about the Underground Railroad in Iowa. And over the last 11 years, the Iowa Freedom Trail Project has had researchers, historians, archaeologists, people researching the history of the Underground Railroad in Iowa, a history that was nearly lost. And now this book, Necessary Courage, Iowa's Underground Railroad and the Struggle Against Slavery, is really the culmination of that project. It's written by Lowell Sohi. He's retired from the State Historic Preservation Office of the State Historical Society of Iowa, and he was director of the Iowa Freedom Trail Project. And archaeologist Doug Jones is also here. He is the Iowa Freedom Trail Grant Project Manager, and he's also based at the State Historic Preservation Office and has been a guest many times on Talk of Iowa talking about the Underground Railroad. The three of us will also be together this afternoon at the State Historical Museum of Iowa from 4:30 to 6. I'll be interviewing them on stage. It's a program that's free and available to the public and will be followed by a book signing this afternoon as well. And, okay, before the break, we were talking about the story of John Walker and his family. And John Walker was a former slave who was trying to bring the rest of his family to freedom. And this created a lot of conflict along the border between Iowa and Missouri. And, Lowell, in the book, you publish a map that you, and I'm sure others as well, created of the route of the Underground Railroad in Iowa. And I think it's definitely worth talking about that this was something that happened really in basically the four southern tiers of counties in the state of Iowa. And tell me, where were the people who came into southern Iowa trying to go? What was their route?
They were, I don't know if they knew exactly where their destination was. Most of the people that came through Iowa were moved toward Chicago and through northern Illinois and Chicago. And then some continued on into Canada. But whether they knew that when they left Missouri or whether they were trying to get away from bad situations and abuse, you know, is just hard to know. And that hasn't really survived.
Well, and in some of the stories that you published, I mean, people would come into Iowa from Missouri and be nearly starved because they didn't have provisions with them and just take their chances knocking on somebody's door. So they didn't necessarily know who was going to be friendly to them.
That's right. One step at a time, kind of, you know, if you were lucky enough to run into some folks who were willing to help you along the way, such as those who were part of this underground network, railroad network, sort of that loose grouping of folks that were trying to help, then you could move faster through the state and on to a better place. But otherwise, they just kept moving, looking for people that would help them along their way.
Well, and I was struck in reading about the different communities that were pockets of abolitionists, or as you said earlier, abolitionist holes, according to the Missourians, Doug. Yeah. You know, I was looking at these different communities, and I was struck by the character of some of these communities, because there were some towns in Iowa that really grew out of this strong anti-slavery feeling. I mean, that was the reason that this community came together, right?
Yeah, and we've actually been thinking about this a little bit more intensively since I had the opportunity to teach for one afternoon a history class from Drake University. And one of the comments after we did our four-hour classroom session was, well, you know, when you look at a lot of the people that we talk about in these communities, many of the people that were involved with Underground Railroad activities were not the nobodies in the communities. They were the community leaders. They were the lawyers, the doctors, the people that were supposed to be enforcing the law. You know, these were not the nobodies in the communities. As John Zeller, our research historian that started off the project, said many years ago, these were the big somebodies in the community. Mm. And when you look at some of these communities like Grinnell and Salem, Denmark, a lot of these people were being consistently elected to various public offices. And it's always been the perception in history that the abolitionists were a minority within those towns. But I think in like with Grinnell and some of these other towns, I would really question that, because maybe the abolitionists were in the minority, but yet they were still electing all of these officials, you know, these people that were actively involved doing Underground Railroad activities and other abolitionist activities as well. They kept getting elected.
So there were towns in which the people who held the power were abolitionists and were making these things happen. I mean, there are a number of stories where the people, the slave hunters who came to take fugitives back into slavery, would apply for the warrant that they needed to arrest somebody, and there would be a lot of stalling. And they didn't seem to carry a lot of paperwork with them anyway in a lot of these stories.
Yes.
But, you know, there were a lot of different ways that the system resisted these slave hunters in these different stories. Do you have an idea if that was the norm, or were these anomalies?
I think it really went from a case-by-case basis, and depending on which personality was involved with the story, because, you know, as we know today, each person is their own person, and we all react differently. And sometimes, you know, I think some of the brilliant things that happened in these stories, people just, you know, okay, well, this is what we're going to do today because of these conditions, or just, you know, reacting to, you know, a group of bounty hunters coming up to your door. And it's like, okay, what are we going to do now? And sometimes they had an idea and sometimes they didn't, and they just reacted.
When we're talking about the folks that made a difference in the communities, the leaders, they were the ones that were maybe deciding what should be done and how to go about it. But the ones who actually carried it out were usually their kids. And they were the ones with the adventurous spirit and wanting to do something. And so the job of carrying the folks in the wagons and stuff was oftentimes done by the kids in their 20s and early 30s.
Well, as time went on before the Civil War began, the feeling, the anti-slavery feeling in Iowa seemed to grow a lot. And, I mean, a piece of evidence for that was Governor James Grimes was elected. Can you tell me a little bit about him and his role in the anti-slavery movement?
He had always been anti-slavery, but what really drew him his feelings to the surface in the form of speeches and was the creation of the Kansas-Nebraska Act. And what that upset the apple cart politically throughout the nation, but especially in the West, which bordered on Kansas, Nebraska. And up till that point, the Democrats had been in control almost since the beginning of the territory. But with all the mayhem that occurred about whether Kansas or Nebraska should become slave or free, and in fact, you might have end up with slavery on your in Nebraska. That James Grimes took as an opportunity to really raise the issue of: do we really want this to happen? We need to change the politics around here so that it doesn't happen. And so he went around the state as candidate for governor in 1854 and made 30 speeches around in the state. And there was prompted all kinds of town meetings, but they called them anti-Nebraska meetings, and because it was sort of against the Nebraska Act that would allow that to happen, kind of thing. And so it really moved the whole nature of the debate in the state. And it found ready ears among all those Ohioans and New Yorkers that were now flooding into the state that weren't there 10 years earlier. With his election as governor and the state essentially became Republican from that point on.
As the politics in the state changed, of course, there were still freedom seekers coming through the state. You mentioned some of the kids of abolitionists carrying out these rescues. There's one story that you wrote about where it almost sounded like a lark. You know, somebody said, oh, hey, you know, this guy, he's a free man, but he wants to rescue his family. They're 60 miles into Missouri. Let's go get him tomorrow. And
yes.
A really poorly planned rescue, although it did work.
Yeah, they were just lucky that it was sort of an unsettled part of Missouri and that they had to go through. And that they could go slow, and that evidently the people that who were the slave masters must not have gotten an early start in trying to catch them because they really
they weren't able
dragged
to
along
quickly.
Getting
and
back.
They
horses were tired, and they didn't, and they tried to use their saddle horses to haul the wagons, and they got very tired quickly, and so it was just quite.
And they ran out of food a day and a half into the journey, they didn't have any provisions. And they rescued, was it 15 people?
Yes, I think that surprised them. They thought it was just going to be this one fellow's family, but then a lot of others joined in and climbed on the wagon. Yeah, it was like 15.
There's one story that you also write about in the book that I would love to follow up on. But I think before we talk about that, we should talk about Tabor, Iowa. And Doug, maybe you can help us out with this, because Tabor, Iowa, and a little community called Civil Bend, these were really remarkable communities in Iowa. Can you give us just a thumbnail sketch of Civil Bend and Tabor?
Sure. We'll start off with Civil Bend. You had the arrival of a number of people in this. It never really was a community, per se, or a town. It was more of a rural community. And you had some interesting personalities showing up there early. And many of these people had been involved with being out on the different Indian reservations and working with different Indian tribes. And some of the early people that arrived out there were residents at Oberlin, Ohio, and had attended Oberlin University, which was a leading abolitionist university, and some people would argue very, at times, ultra-abolitionist, because at Oberlin, they really got into a lot more discussions about rights issues and who had rights and when they had rights. And so you had some of these early people like Lester and Elvira Platt that show up out at Civil Bend, and Dr. Ira Blanchard, who's probably one of my favorite characters out of this whole story. He did a lot of good things. He also did a few bad things. But when it came to the Underground Railroad,
and there's a picture of him in the book.
There is a picture of him in the book.
Piercing eyes.
he was a no nonsense kind of guy, by all accounts, and he wasn't afraid to go do things that other people probably would hesitate to even consider.
And most remarkably, the kidnapping of Maria and Henry Garner, and he chased the folks all the way to St. Louis and got them freed from the slave pens where they'd been hauled to, or the kidnappers had taken them.
Wow.
So
yeah. And then, you know, from Civil Bend, and I can't remember, I think it was, about 1854, when a whole bunch of the folks that had come out from Oberlin decided, well, there was a really bad flood on the Missouri. The mosquitoes were really, really bad. And also there were some discontent with Dr. Ira Blanchard within the community. So a number of people decided, you know, let's head for the hills. And they moved up into the Lost Hills and founded the town of Tabor, right on the border of the Fremont and Mills County line. And Tabor became a very strong congregational town, and Tabor was also played a huge role in the Kansas and Nebraska Act, and fighting for the free state status of Kansas and Nebraska.
And when you say fighting, actual fighting, I mean, they were stockpiling weapons.
Yeah, they were a supply depot. They had people coming there. They had supplies coming there. They had people coming back from Kansas, like John Brown and James Lane, that sometimes they had to get out of Kansas, or they needed some downtime. They needed some place to go hide and heal up with wounds and resupply. So Tabor was a very important place because it was really the last major depot in Iowa to send people and supplies from before you went into Nebraska. And so you just had a huge amount of people. You couldn't go through Missouri if you were going out to Kansas to fight for free state rights. You just couldn't do that. So most of that traffic was going through Iowa, and the Lane Trail, there were a number of people who were doing Underground Railroad activities, such as William Penn Clark, who were working with James Lane on establishing a trail to get people and supplies out there to Kansas. And Tabor played a huge role in that.
Well, in the book, Lowell, you write about a slave owner, Stephen F. Knuckles, who was...
The founding spirit of Nebraska City, just across the river from Iowa in Nebraska.
Right, and he thought that he would never lose his slaves because they would never try to leave. But, of course, two of them did, and maybe others later on. But I was so struck. I mean, talk about a villain for a story. I was so struck by the lengths that he went to try to get these two women back. And he and the men that joined him, I mean, they beat people within an inch of their lives. Yes. They traveled all over Iowa. And Knuckles actually went to Chicago
the next year, based on a clue he had received from someone that...
And unsuccessfully did try to bring this young woman back. But he must have spent so much money. And you compare the amount of money that he spent to today's dollars. I mean, he must have spent nearly $1 million trying to bring one young woman back in today's dollars.
Yeah, he was one determined guy, that's for sure. It's funny, his villainy continued on into the 1870s and 80s. Wyoming was one of those that women got the vote, you know, and he was a member of the state legislature at the time, and he was one that stood up again to fight against women getting the vote. So his villainy continued.
All right. As time went on, and you were talking, Doug, about the fact that there was actual real fighting involved in the fight over slavery, and we don't have time to talk a lot about John Brown and the followers that he gathered in the state of Iowa, but as time went on, of course, there was a divide over people who were willing to go to war to fight against slavery and people who were not willing to actually take it that far. But there was support in Iowa and way to the governor's office for John Brown and those who were willing to start a war and fight a war over this.
Yes.
Yeah, that, there was a clear divide between those that were willing to go into Missouri to help rescue slaves and those that were just willing to help those that escaped to Iowa. Mm-hmm. And, that was the divide.
And you also write that I get the impression, at least, that you feel that we have been done a disservice over the years by historians telling us that the Civil War was not a war about slavery.
Yes, that in the post-Civil War years, there was this move for reconciliation. Everyone was so tired of what had happened and everything, and the desire to heal everything. But in the process, what was lost was remembering those that had fought so hard to against slavery and helping people in the Underground Railroad, and forgetting was one of the costs of the reconciliation.
So are there a lot more stories out there that you haven't been able to find about the Underground Railroad in Iowa?
I would say definitely yes. Matter of fact, there's not one day that goes by that there isn't some new tantalizing piece of information surfacing about a new potential news story or a new person that had not been previously identified being associated with either abolitionist or Underground Railroad activities. And that's one of the fun things, too. This is a bit like CSI on the TV because, you know, you're basically trying to go back and, you know, recreate the crime scene with these stories, so to speak, and trying to piece together all this information based on the historical evidence that you can is available to you or that you can find. This evidence is, you know, we talked about it a little bit already. You know, there are some firsthand accounts. There are some firsthand pieces of information or even artifacts that have been found. Those are very rare. But a lot of what we have are later recollections from the children that may have been involved directly with these activities. They may be recollections from the next generation beyond that. And so you never know where you're going to find information.
Yeah. One of the things we hope will come out of this book and the others is that it will pull more information from the family archives that people have and that they will move it out into public view so that we can flesh out some of these stories in greater depth.
And there are still a few places in Iowa where we can go and actually see evidence of this work, right, Doug?
Yes.
Can you just give me a – there aren't many places.
Well, you know, that's one of the unfortunate results of our 11 years of working is that we have come to – well, actually, we came to a very quick conclusion that there are very few of these places left that still extant around the state. The four best places to go experience this history in the state, starting in far southwest Iowa, would be the Reverend John Todd House in Tabor. You also have in Lewis, Iowa, you have the Reverend George Hitchcock House. Here in West Des Moines, you have the James Jordan House and property. And in southeast Iowa, you have the Llewellyn Gibbs House is what it's referred to on the Network to Freedom, but the Henderson Llewellyn House down in Salem.
Well, we are out of time. Thank you both so much for being here today.
Thank you, Charity. Yeah.
Archaeologist Doug Jones and Lowell Soike. He's retired from the State Historic Preservation Office and the author of the new book, Necessary Courage, Iowa's Underground Railroad in the Struggle Against Slavery. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.